loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein turned himself into New York police this morning to face felony rape charges. Weinstein also has been accused of sexually harassing, abusing, and assaulting dozens of women over the years. Meanwhile, at least eight women have come forward to accuse film star Morgan Freeman of making unwanted sexual advances to them. Freeman released a statement saying, quote, "I apologize to anyone who felt uncomfortable or disrespected. That was never my intent," unquote. Next, Julian Assange's nearly six-year refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London is in jeopardy, multiple sources are telling CNN. If the Ecuadorians expel him, he will likely be arrested by British authorities and extradited to the United States. Then, Australia and the Netherlands say they are holding Russia responsible for the downing of a Malaysia Airlines passenger jet that killed 298 people in 2014. Dutch investigators on Thursday concluded that the missile that brought the jet down over rebel-held territory in Ukraine belonged to a Russian brigade. Is this a sure thing, or is this the fog of war? And then Colombia will hold national elections on Sunday, and it appears likely that left-wing candidate Gustavo Petro and far-right contender Iván Duque will advance to the second round. The election is the first since an historic peace deal ended a 50-year-long war between the government and the FARC insurgent group and could decide its fate. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to New York and the arrest of Harvey Weinstein. Former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein turned himself into New York police this morning to face felony rape charges. Weinstein also has been accused of sexually harassing, abusing, and assaulting dozens of women over the years. Meanwhile, at least eight women have come forward to accuse film star Morgan Freeman of making unwanted sexual advances at them. Freeman released a statement today saying, quote, "I apologize to anyone who felt uncomfortable or disrespected. That was never my intent," unquote. We're joined from New York by Heidi Bogosian. She's the executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute, and she's the former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. Welcome back.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Heidi, this can't be a new phenomenon, right? I mean, sexual harassment, sexual assault has been going on since the dawn of time. Is it that people are more attuned to it, or is it that women are have gotten to the point where they feel confident enough to come out with it?
I think it's a combination of both. What we're seeing is a very strong movement rising up, as we say, from the streets. And historically, when we see changes to the laws in this country, adherence to the U.S. Constitution, we often see it coming from a very strong people's movement, where the narratives of individuals affected by such misconduct, in this case sexual harassment and even rape, they swell to such a level that the courts can no longer ignore them. And we know that in 2015, for example, the New York District Attorney declined to prosecute Weinstein, even though they had on tape the fact that he had touched a woman's breasts inappropriately. Fast forward to now, I think the courts simply cannot ignore what's coming up from the public. And, you know, this goes back to the days of the abolitionist movement, who challenged the fugitive slave laws in court for their unconstitutionality. Now, they lost again and again, but what happened was they helped mobilize Northern opinion against these slave laws and against Northern cooperation with slavery. And I think you see that over and over again. Courts either being, not ruling in a way that we would think is proper, but then having the public become aware of it, or vice versa, becoming aware of it in the courts of public opinion, and then the justice system simply has to act.
I have to ask you how this plays out now in a New York courtroom. Harvey Weinstein has been accused of very serious crimes. Really, this is a crime of violence, a major felony. He has all the money in the world, and indeed he put up $1 million in cash today against a $10 million bond, and he was released immediately. But assuming he's found guilty, as most people are in American courts, what happens to him next?
Well, I like to think that New Yorkers are pretty tuned into this kind of injustice.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen, of course, powerful and wealthy men get off on their reputation, and just because it's dismissed as, well, yes, he did something wrong, but, you know, too big to fail, whatever. I think that everyone will be watching to see what happens in the Weinstein case, and I am hopeful that a New York judge, if he is found guilty, which I imagine he will be, will mete out a harsh and appropriate punishment. That's what I would hope we'll see. And I think that the public here especially, as across the country, is looking at this case to see how it's going to play out.
Yeah, you know, to go back to that historical analogy you were making with the abolitionist movement and how that was able to influence court rulings over time, and how the women's liberation movement is doing, you know, a similar thing here. I mean, Harvey Weinstein, like, one of the reasons why he was said to be so prolific in these alleged sexual assaults, you know, he felt impunity. He thought that the courts would never touch him. He was too rich. He was too powerful. He was too well-connected. But it was the outrage of millions and millions of people all over the country and maybe even all over the world that changed the political situation, right? The political situation such that he has to face at least a trial and maybe, you know, justice for the crimes that he's, you know, been alleged to commit by many, 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 many people. Just talk about that dynamic a little bit more, about the struggle in the streets impacting the courts, because there's this myth, I think it's a myth, that the courts are, you know, above politics, above society, removed from all of those things. But that's not really historically true, is it?
No, it isn't. I think that courts can be seen really as one element of several. Many people often say that the fourth branch of government is we the people. If successful, public movements like the Me Too movement influence public opinion gradually in their favor, and that then changes the culture within our Constitution interacts. I think that courts and other leadership institutions absorb these cultural shifts, and movements then in turn convince political parties to support their views. Those views, those parties may then appoint judges with similar views. But I really think that the people are the most effective force to hold accountable our courts, and they are not immune to public opinion. They're definitely listening. I mean, look at some of the cases, Loving v. Virginia, about interracial marriage.
Right.
Public opinion changes over time. It's not a stagnant element, and courts listen to that voice. So the louder the voice of the people, I think the faster we bring in line all those other factors that ultimately show how we enforce our laws and how the Constitution may gradually become either a more progressive or, hopefully not, a more restrictive body.
Heidi, one of the accusations made against Harvey Weinstein is that he forced a woman to perform a sex act on him in 2004. She gave an interview to Ronan Farrow of The New Yorker magazine last year and made the allegation. That's one of the two very serious charges. The other is a charge of forcible felony rape against a woman who has not gone public, so we don't know her identity. How does a prosecutor go about prosecuting a case where so much time has elapsed between the crime or the alleged crime and the trial?
Prosecutors definitely have a challenge. I understand that what they may do is call on women to testify over the years to establish what we call a pattern of prior bad acts.
Uh-huh.
They did that, I believe, in the Bill Cosby trial. But a judge would have to permit that testimony. It's up to the judicial discretion. It's a challenge, and it's especially more of a challenge when you have clients with deep pockets and power, such as Mr. Weinstein, who are going to have a team of high-priced attorneys. They'll have their own investigators. They'll do everything they can to malign these women. But again, we're in New York. I'm hopeful that a judge might allow a history of prior bad acts in. And I also think they can't ignore what we're seeing in the public with the many women that are coming forward. I should add that, and I think you alluded to this, it's much easier for women who are intimidated by men with such sway, such as Harvey Weinstein. They become emboldened, I think, to share their stories as more and more come out. They don't feel as alone. And that's the importance of sharing these narratives as part of court case. I just want to quickly add that in the early 70s in New York State, several young women attorneys brought lawsuits challenging New York State's restrictive abortion laws. They brought in the stories of the women who were impacted. And as a result, those personal stories got those restrictive laws overturned, not only in New York, but other states in New England as well.
When you're up against somebody like Harvey Weinstein, who has, you know, seemingly endless amounts of money, or, you know, some of these other people who have been accused of sexual assault, who also are extremely wealthy, if you're just doing that as an individual, it's very easy to feel alone and isolated and unwilling to take that huge risk. But there's something about collective action, right, of organization of many, many, many women coming forward that gives you strength, that is really the stuff that movements are made out of. Just 30 seconds left. Comment on that, if you would.
Strength in that, and I think what also helps is we're seeing other men, wealthy men like a New York restaurateur and others who are being accused of really egregious acts. For example, a rape room above a restaurant, where more than one individual has given her story about what happened there. So I think we're going to see more men being accused with solid evidence against them, and that, too, really makes a strong case that this is an unacceptable pattern and practice.
Okay, we will leave it there. We're out of time. We were joined from New York by Heidi Bogosian. She's the executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute and the former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Julian Assange's nearly six-year refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London is in jeopardy, multiple sources are telling CNN. If the Ecuadorians expel him, he will likely be arrested by British authorities and extradited to the United States. We're going to talk about this with Randy Credico, who joins us from New York. Randy is an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. He's also a candidate for governor of New York. Randy, welcome back.
Yes. A soon-to-be erstwhile candidate for governor of New York, I think. I got too much on my plate to try to woo Democratic voters in the state of New York.
You are busy and stretched thin. I want to ask you about Julian Assange. I've not seen until today language like this in articles about Assange's situation in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. They're using the word grave, that the situation is grave. Tell us what you know.
Yes. Well, I know that I've gotten it from various sources, that, and even CNN with that with their intelligence guy, who's not that intelligent, Jim Sciotto, came out today with a story that the situation is very fluid right now, and the word is that either today or tomorrow, Mr. Assange could be expelled from that embassy, which you have pointed out he would immediately be arrested on an old bail jumping charge by the British police. 6 years now. 6 years he's avoided paying bail, or, you know, not paying bail jumping. And then he'll probably have to go through an extradition process and then get sent to the U.S. According to Sessions, this is a top priority of theirs. And I don't know if they're bluffing or what, if they got papers, if they pursued a case against them on some bogus Espionage Act charges. I don't know. But obviously, they've kept them muffled for the last 6 years as much as they possibly can.
They have.
They kept them
There are rumors, yes, of course, that he would be charged with espionage in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is called the Espionage Court because it covers both the CIA and the Pentagon. But if a grand jury has been meeting, it's not yet leaked out. Now, you're right about this bail jumping thing. This is just a flimsy excuse for the British to grab him and turn him over to the Americans, because this doesn't have anything to do with sexual assault charges in Sweden anymore. Both women have withdrawn those charges, saying that they were pressured into making the charges in the first place.
Right,
this has
right.
all and, been about and, getting him to the United States.
Yes. It goes even further than that. Marianne Nye, who was a prosecutor, wanted to drop the case 5 years ago, and the British government, the Crown Prosecutor Services, they intimidated her, forced her to keep the case open. So they had an excuse to keep him in there. They really wanted him in there, and then they really wanted him quiet the last couple of months as they were leading up. It's really the timing with the Skripal case in Salisbury and the Syrian gas and all of that. He was starting to talk about that on top of Catalan, but I think that the Brits, when King Salman went to the U.S., France, and then Britain, you knew something was coming, and he probably snipped that out, and he would have been talking about that, and they don't want him talking about it. He's a journalist. They want to keep him quiet. They don't want their crimes to be exposed.
And what a dangerous precedent this would set. I mean, if he is extradited to the United States and charged with espionage, I mean, it would have such a chilling effect on the profession of journalism, you know, real journalism, you know, journalism that challenges the rich and powerful.
Well, how could he be charged with espionage? He's not a U.S. citizen.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like charging somebody from Bulgaria for espionage just because he wrote a story slamming. I mean, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, La Repubblica, papers around the world have taken Julian Assange's war logs and turned them into stories. So they've done the same thing that he's done. It's just that they didn't get the original leak, and they were leaks. They were not hacks.
Yeah.
The war logs and the Clinton DNC, and everyone says that the Russians took it. And, you know, the whole thing smells, and they want to quiet Julian Assange. He represents a danger. And what's really frustrating is that you don't have the mainstream media supporting him en masse, which is what they should be doing en masse, because if he goes, the dominoes all fall, even though they're not really unbiased journalists, and they may as well be working for the Defense Department, a lot of these guys at CNN. But if he goes, then that sets a very dangerous precedent, and they should be standing up. They should be circling the wagons. I mean, look, I don't watch Fox News. I don't watch any of those programs, but I don't think they should take them off. I don't think that they should be muzzled because I don't like some of the programming. You know, if I don't watch CNN, I don't watch Wolf Blitzer. But if you want to have it on, fine. You don't muzzle dissent. You don't muzzle the First Amendment, no matter how much it is perverted.
Yeah, it seems like there's sort of two models of journalism, right? There's like the journalism that Julian Assange and others like him practice, where you go out and you acquire information. But then there's the type of journalism that we see from most of these mainstream corporate outlets, like you were listing. You know, they'll publish these stories once the information is out there, once news organizations like WikiLeaks put them out there. But really, what they're looking for is access, right? They want to have access to these rich politicians or corporate leaders or whatever, so that they can be sort of the depository of leaks and information and tips. It's sort of like a fundamentally different and more establishment friendly model, right?
Yes, it definitely is something that these guys are doing to get access. Obviously, I guess, and you know, Barbara Starr, for instance, she's right. She may as well be working right out of the Pentagon press office. Jim Sciotto out of the CIA or out of the NSA press office. He definitely has access. This kid Manu Rahu, you always see him hanging out with the Intelligence Committee leaders. You know, like Adam Schiff, he gets all the leaks. So it seems like it's basically an infomercial at times.
So, Randy, tell me, besides just being reactive to this, what's Julian doing to prepare for whatever the government's or multiple governments' next steps are going to be?
Well, there are a lot of people out there on the streets protesting. They have vigils. He's got really a all-star legal team, a lot of great lawyers. I mean, they're preparing, I suppose, some kind of a fight. The ACLU came out today and said this would be unprecedented for him to be extradited. And first of all, it's a violation of the Constitution of Ecuador. It's granted under Article 79, which says Ecuador's constitution guarantees non-extradition of nationals. In no case shall extradition of an Ecuadorian be granted. And he's an Ecuadorian right now, Article 79. And ban on return of refugees, Article 4. Okay, the state shall respect and guarantee the principle of non-return. So that's in the Constitution. And if Lenin were to uphold the Constitution, he would not participate in the expulsion of Julian Assange. I mean, look, if he does, this looks really bad for him. He looks like Batista or Trujillo or one of these other Banana Republic leaders, rather than in the spirit of Bolivar, O'Higgins, and San Martin. He should be operating under the spirit of those revolutionaries that even brought these countries into being.
That's another important angle of this, right? That this is yet another act of bullying, of aggression by the United States government against a country in Latin America, you know, a region that it arrogantly considers its backyard, you know, at least since the Monroe Doctrine in the early 1800s. I mean, that's an important thing to keep in mind here, that the U.S. government, a very powerful government, is trying to bully a smaller country into doing something that, like you said, is actually unconstitutional.
Yes, it's totally unconstitutional. But, you know, you got to understand, now that Pompeo is, he really hates Assange. He's the Secretary of State. You can imagine the kind of pressure. They've already got maneuvers there, joint maneuvers that Lenin has signed with the U.S. To as they have in Argentina. So the U.S. has been basically out of South America and more in Africa and the Middle East and in Asia and all of that. But now they're returning the hegemony of that region, and the State Department is facilitating that. They're putting the pressure. Who knows what kind of pressure Lenin is getting on him? I know that former President Correa definitely would not comply with the U.S. pressure. He was that independent. But, you know, you don't know what happens. If they are signing these pacts, you don't know what happens. You know, the trade deals, they were omitted from any kind of tariff, Ecuador. You know, so there's a lot of pressure that can be applied here. And there's a lot of Ecuadorians that live in the U.S., I think like 600,000 just in the state of New York.
The day after Walter and I delivered a letter to the Ecuadorian embassy asking them to reconnect Julian's internet and to allow him to have visitors, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal the very next day, and it was entitled, Ecuador is Open for Business. And it talked about how the Ecuadorian government had approached the Trump administration in an effort to increase Ecuadorian imports to the United States, and that the Trump people were willing to listen to the pitch. Well, I can't help but to think that a part of that pitch was, we want you to throw Julian Assange out of that embassy because we want to grab him and we want to put him on trial here in Virginia.
That could be the case, but a lot of it, I think, is a huge bluff. Can you imagine the kind of, if he were to be brought here, the international pressure that would be applied on the U.S., the kind of rallies that would take place? Journalists at that point, you treat this brilliant man, all right, he's the Einstein of journalism. You know, he's that brilliant. To bring him over here and put him in that situation, put him in the court of espionage there in Virginia, which, is, of course, is a kangaroo court. Not unlike any other court in this country, because they're all kangaroo courts. There's no justice in or out of court. So he would have no shot there, and they just put him through the motions there, just like they did Socrates, Sacco and Vincetti, the Haymarket defendants.
Yeah.
That's what would happen.
That's what we're looking at here. We're out of time. We were joined by Randy Credico. He's in New York. Randy's an activist, a comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. And he's also a candidate for governor of New York, at least for a little while.
At least for another week.
Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host, Walter Smolarek. Australia and the Netherlands say they are holding Russia responsible for the downing of a Malaysia Airlines passenger jet that killed 298 people in 2014. Dutch investigators on Thursday concluded that the missile that brought the jet down over rebel-held territory in Ukraine belonged to a Russian brigade. Is this a sure thing, or is this the fog of war? We're joined from Moscow by Dmitry Babich. He's a journalist and commentator with Sputnik International. Welcome, Dmitry.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
Dmitry, the Dutch investigators have completed their report and they issued it yesterday. Their conclusion is that this plane was brought down either by Russians or by groups associated with Russians or the Russian military. But the evidence is circumstantial. What is your take?
Well, I think that this is still a very mysterious story, but it's just amazing how the Western government quickly come to conclusions, how they support always the anti-Russian side. And it's interesting how the Western world is simply blind to what the Ukrainian government was doing. And let me tell you, of course, it was horrible that 298 people died on board of that crashed plane. But during the same month, okay, maybe 2 months in summer 2014, about 9,000 people were killed when the Ukrainian government started bombing and shelling the cities in the east of its own country, simply because they didn't accept the new regime that came to power as a result of a violent coup. If I'm told that the coup in Ukraine was not violent, I can ask my American opponents what would be done to people who would try to topple the president, killing 32 policemen. So the Ukrainian aviation at the time, you know, killed hundreds of people in Donetsk. But obviously, the lives of these people don't count. What counts are the lives of 298 people who died in that crash plane, which was hit by an anti-aircraft missile, which the Dutch investigators are saying belonged to a Russian missile. From a Russian military unit in a nearby city of Kursk. What is amazing is that hours after, you know, the Dutch investigators made this statement, not supported by any evidence published, immediately NATO Secretary General said that Russia should take responsibility for the misfortune that happened. The United States government said that Russia should take responsibility, and the Australian foreign minister said that she would pursue Russians with a Lockerbie-style case. So this is, in fact, you know, one more demonstration of how quickly the Western governments come to conclusions when they're dealing with a country they consider an enemy, and how blind they are to crimes of their own so-called friends.
So, Dmitry, what is the technical evidence here? What hard evidence do we have to look at? I mean, of course, there's lots of circumstantial factors to consider. There's, you know, the political situation. What exists in terms of hard physical evidence?
Well, the Dutch investigators say that the Buk missile, which downed the plane, had what they called a Russian fingerprint. The fingerprint is not exactly identified in what was made public, but the press quotes the investigators as saying that the fingerprint was a vehicle number, transport marking, and a white spot. Obviously, by the vehicle, they mean the truck that supposedly brought Buk to eastern Ukraine from Russia. Well, let me tell you that, you know, this was said by the Ukrainian government from the beginning, that they managed to intercept the conversations of the people who downed the plane. Later on, somehow, they could never confirm how they made those recordings. Let me tell you that millions of people in Russia and in Ukraine, in fact, dozens of millions, speak the same language. So it's very easy to fake any conversation. These recordings were obviously thrown out of the case later. Also, the Ukrainian government somehow always refused to publish the conversations between the pilots of MH17 and the Ukrainian ground control, even though these conversations were obviously recorded. So instead of having access to actual talks, to actual recordings, were told by the Dutch investigators that we should believe what they call curious motorists who shot video footage of the convoy as it traveled through Western Russia. They say there were dozens of such curious motorists. Well, I just don't believe it, because when you have such a powerful weapon, let me tell you that Buk missile is in fact a complex. It's a huge missile which can only be used with a radar, with a lot of additional equipment. In fact, it's a real convoy. So the military people would take care not to allow these dozens of curious motorists to shoot any video. Believe me, that's how it is done in any such like situations. We don't know anything else. I mean, the Russian side is not taking part in the investigation. The Russian President Putin said that until we're not allowed to take part in the investigation, until our arguments are simply dismissed, without any consideration, we will not recognize the results of this investigation. So it looks like right after the Skripal case got into a deadlock, obviously both of the so-called victims of the Russian nerve agent are alive, which is impossible if indeed they were poisoned by a powerful military killing gas. So as soon as the Skripal case has run into problems, they immediately took out this old story about MH17.
Dmitry, tell me why the investigators have not come forward with the information that it seems to me would be critical and easily released, like the recordings.
Well, they actually say that it was the same information that was used by the so-called investigative website Bellingcat back in 2014. Well, Bellingcat was always accusing Russia. It cannot be called an objective source of information. But obviously, the investigation has run into such problems that they decided to use the good old Bellingcat in this situation. It's like asking the Russian FSB Secret Service about the actions of, say, Americans in Syria. Of course, there will be a lot of accusations. I think that the Russian Defense Ministry presented the other point of view when they simply dismissed the so-called new facts by saying that they, in fact, repeated what Bellingcat said 4 years ago.
Yeah, the violence in Ukraine now has subsided, even though the conflict is far from resolved, in part because of the Minsk Accords. But in 2014, I mean, the situation was a true crisis that seemed like it had the potential to escalate in a way that might be uncontrollable by all sides involved. And this MH17 downing really played a major role in turning up the temperature even further. Tell us a little bit about, what the situation was in 2014 when this happened.
Well, the situation is terrible even now, because people get killed on the so-called dividing line in eastern Ukraine every day. And there is a lot of bad expectations, that World Cup will be held in Russia in June, and one of the main venues is right next to this area in Rostov. So a lot of people connect the rise in violence with this coming World Cup. Let me remind you that the Georgian dictator Saakashvili started his attack on South Ossetia on the first day of the Olympic Games in Beijing, and the violent coup in Kiev, which ousted President Yanukovych, took place during the Olympic Games in Sochi. So the Russians and the people living in the east of Ukraine are very concerned about the coming weeks. As for 2014, it was just horrible, because basically what happened was that after the new crudely nationalist regime was established in Kiev, Donetsk and Lugansk simply refused to submit. And I understand why. If you look at the Ukrainian nationalist press in the years after 1991, Donetsk and its people were portrayed as enemies. They were called all kinds of dismissive names. You can even find them in the Western press. Andrew Nagorsky from Newsweek magazine called the people of Donetsk Homo Soveticus. So you can easily find his article. And basically, people refused to live under this new regime. They held a referendum, which was, of course, dismissed by the new regime in Kyiv and by the West. And then the newly elected President Poroshenko started a real military onslaught on Donbas. Donetsk and Lugansk were bombed several times. And what was the most outrageous about it was that when thousands of people, you know, were dying in that area, Poroshenko toured the United States, Canada, and the EU member countries, and everywhere he got standing ovations.
Dmitry, I'm sorry to say that we're completely out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. We were joined from Moscow by Dmitry Babich. Dmitry is a journalist and commentator with Sputnik International. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Colombia will hold national elections on Sunday, and it appears likely that left-wing candidate Gustavo Petro and far-right contender Iván Duque will advance to the second round. The election is the first since an historic peace deal ended a 50-year-long war between the government and the FARC insurgent group and could decide its fate. Walter, why is this race so important, and why is the political left so strong right now?
Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons why it's so important. The principal one, like you were talking about in the introduction, is the future of the peace process in Colombia. You know, there is a longstanding insurgency led by the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. But, you know, that's their former name now. They've signed this peace agreement with the government. They've transitioned to a political party, the Revolutionary Alternative Force of the Commons. So, you know, retaining the same acronym, but changing their name to reflect the fact that they've, you know, switched their status from an insurgent armed group into an organization that's committed to, you know, above ground, peaceful political struggle. So Iván Duque is the presidential candidate who's backed by former President Uribe, who is, you know, I think you could charitably call him a far right politician. He has been accused over and over and over again of being tight with the extreme right wing paramilitary organizations that terrorize social movements in the countryside. And, you know, when he was the president, there were many scandals that came out about his relationship with paramilitaries and in a related way, drug trafficking. So Iván Duque is the other major candidate. But like you said, Gustavo Petro, who is the left wing candidate, is also very strong. And of course, while Duque is, you know, virulently opposed to the agreement with the FARC, Gustavo Petro believes that the peace agreement is, you know, should be maintained. It should be strengthened. It should move, you know, the society should move forward on that basis, which covers not just the FARC itself, but also a number of political and social issues related to the countryside, related to political rights, the end of paramilitarism. So they're really fundamentally different views about how Colombian society should be structured, who should have power, who should be empowered by the government's policies. And it's really a stark choice. There are a number of other candidates as well in the Colombian election, but they generally fall into those two different camps. You could say there's sort of the pro-peace camp and then the anti-peace deal camp, with Duque being the leader of that faction.
There's a poll that came out in Colombia just a couple of days ago that that shows Petro in second place, trailing Duque being the right winger, by 12 percentage points. But then the article goes on to say that that's actually not insurmountable, because it all depends on turnout. And it depends on turnout in the villages and in the countryside where Petro is at his most popular. He's also been successful so far in framing the election around the idea of redistribution of land. He's proposing that the government buy large tracts of land from former drug cartels, essentially, surrounding the cities of Cali and Medellin, and then dividing up those enormous parcels and just giving them to the poor to farm. Is this an issue that can stick?
Yeah, I think the issue of land and land inequality is a defining one in Colombian politics. You know, the beginning of the FARC insurgency in, I believe, 1964 was really the result of a number of disputes between peasant organizations who are fighting for their right to a decent standard of living and the redistribution of land against, you know, death squads that were hired by big landlords to oppose those efforts. And, you know, there's sort of self-acting autonomous militias that existed on a local level. And then there is, you know, a confederation of those into the FARC, which then adopted a socialist communist ideology. So if Petro is, you know, going to people in the countryside who have been most affected by the armed conflict and saying, you know, not only do we want peace, but we want the redistribution of land. We want social justice so that you and your family can have a higher standard of living. You know, we can, I think, clearly see why that message resonates. You know, the other reason why I think that the differential between Petro, the left-wing candidate, and Duque, the far-right candidate, is not insurmountable is that there's also another candidate who's polling quite high, but not as high as Petro, Sergio Fajardo, who is the candidate of the Green Party, which is, you know, like a center-left political party. They're in favor of the peace process. They're in favor of certain social programs. You know, they're probably amenable to some type of land reform. And also participating in the alliance that's supporting Fajardo is the Alternative Democratic Poll, which is a political party that Gustavo Petro actually used to belong to. So the prospects of Fajardo's voters going for Petro in the second round, which would be, you know, more than enough to make up the difference in the first round, is pretty high. And I think that's what Petro is counting on. There's also another candidate who's generally considered to be friendly to the peace deal, Humberto de la Calle, who is polling, you know, in much smaller numbers, but, you know, his voters are also likely to transfer to Petro in the second round. So I think that, you know, it seems pretty clear that Duque and Petro will be the top two vote getters. Of course, we can't be sure of that. You know, there were, for instance, there was a referendum on the peace accord that narrowly failed because of low voter turnout, and everybody expected it to pass. So, you know, it's not like there's, you know, never any surprises in Colombian elections, but it appears that Petro and Duque will go to the second round, and that second round will be extremely close.
And tell me how this impacts the United States. And clearly, Colombia and the United States have very close relations going back generations. Does it really matter who the president of Colombia is and whether he's from the political left or the political right?
Yeah, you know, former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, I believe, referred to Colombia as the Israel of Latin America, meaning that it's the country that has been for many, many decades and very, very loyally in the United States' camp and will do, you know, more or less what the U.S. government imposes on it. You know, that's referring to the government, of course, not the people and political organizations of Colombia. But, you know, the fact that a peace accord was signed between the FARC and the Colombian government is something that I think made many powerful forces in Washington very upset, because their orientation towards the armed conflict in Colombia is to basically further militarize the situation. And this is partially done under the guise of the war on drugs. You know, there's this line that they've created that the FARC is really just a drug trafficking organization. And so, you know, through a lot of these war on drug funds, through the agency of the DEA, in addition to just, you know, the regular U.S. Military, they've been, you know, pumping arms into the country. They've been, you know, training Colombian military officers, many of whom have, you know, gone on to commit human rights abuses. And there's a particularly unhelpful thing with regard to the peace process that the United States has done, and that's to demand the extradition of Jesus Santrich, who is a prominent FARC leader, to the United States to face criminal charges. This is something that I think is clearly designed to destabilize the peace agreement when it's already quite fragile because of sabotage efforts by, in addition to the United States, of course, with this extradition thing. In addition to that, the Colombian right wing, the domestic elites, have been carrying out campaigns of assassinations targeting social leaders, particularly those in the countryside, leaders of Afro-Colombian communities, leaders of peasant organizations, leaders of women's organizations, to create this climate of violence and fear, one that, of course, is not conducive to national peace, reconciliation, the implementation of progressive policies to better the lives of the majority of people.
Tell us also what this election is going to mean for Venezuela. Venezuela is in a bad place right now, and traditionally, Colombia and Venezuela have been very important to each other, even when relations between the two haven't been very good. So what does this mean for that country?
Yeah, I think it has a lot of relevance for that situation. One is that, you know, as a consequence of this is this 50-year-long war, there's a great number of Colombians living in Venezuela, many millions who are given, you know, more or less full political and social rights. So, you know, that's been something that is actually been a pride, point of pride for the Bolivarian process, that they show solidarity to their neighbors, to other countries in Latin America. But the Venezuelan government, I mean, a lot of their leadership has actually been talking about an overt military operation that would be carried against, that would be carried out, you know, at the behest of the United States, but maybe involving some of their right-wing clients in the region, and Colombia certainly would be at the top of that list, the Colombian government. I think Ivan Duque would be very open to that idea. I mean, if not an overt U.S. military intervention to effect regime change in Venezuela, then to offer up Colombian territory as it really has been functioning over the last several years as a base for groups to operate out of that wish to further destabilize the situation in Venezuela. However, the opposite may be true if Petro wins re-election. You know, he may be able to crack down on some of the smuggling activity, on some of the paramilitary activity that goes along the Colombian-Venezuelan border that has, you know, both a adverse political and a very adverse economic effect, because what a lot of people do is buy subsidized goods in Venezuela, goods that are subsidized by the government, take it to Colombia and sell it at an enormous markup. So if Petro is elected, he may be amenable to taking serious action to reduce those types of activities.
You know, I'm wondering too, we're pretty much out of time, so I just want to offer this up as a final thought. I wonder too, what the Colombian reaction is going to be to the possibility of a refugee crisis in Venezuela. The economy is in such bad shape. Venezuela is under pressure, not just from the United States, but really from most of the rest of the Organization of American States. The current political and economic situation is untenable there. And when that happens, we see it all over the world. It usually ends up in a refugee crisis. Well, we'll leave it there. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Again, we are going to take a look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we're joined in studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you.
Delighted to be here.
You know, we collect these stories all week so we can talk about them on Fridays. And we try to look for stories that are funny or headlines that are misleading. Well, misleading isn't even the word for some of the headlines that we saw this week. And Steve, I want to talk about this Cuban, Luis Posada Carriles. He's a terrorist. There's really no other word for it. The man's a terrorist. He died this week at the age of 90. But you wouldn't know it that he was a terrorist from the obituary headlines that we saw in places like the Miami Herald and the New York Times and the BBC. Go ahead.
Yeah, this was just a sequence of one bad headline after another in one news outlet after another. I'll just read a few of them. He was called an anti-Castro militant by the Miami Herald. The New York Times just said Luis Posada Carriles, who waged quest to oust Castro, dies at 90, as if he was, you know, running in election after election like Alf Landon or something like that in the United States. And the worst of all, in my opinion, was the BBC, whose headline was Luis Posada Carriles, Cuba anti-communist activist dies. Yeah, he was just a guy who, you know, held a protest sign and walked up and down the street saying, you know, down with Cuba or whatever. Of course, none of these things are remotely true. He was a notorious terrorist. He's been called the Osama bin Laden of the Western Hemisphere. In fact, the interesting thing is the Miami Herald, which is the most anti-Cuban revolution newspaper in the country, who just called him an anti-Castro militant, just 6 months ago, they ran a story. This was right after the some of the JFK assassination papers were released, which actually had a lot of information about Posada Carriles. And they ran this whole story, which acknowledged that even the U.S. government considered Posada Carriles a terrorist. But yet that fact that the U.S. government itself calls him a terrorist has totally vanished from these headlines. So it's really disgusting. And of course, the other thing that's totally vanished from the not just the headlines, but many of these articles as well, was that since he entered the United States illegally in 2005, if I'm not mistaken, the United States government was shielding him from extradition to Cuba, where he was to Venezuela, where he was wanted on 73 counts of murder for the airplane bombing.
That's right.
They spent 13 years shielding him from extradition in a disgraceful exhibition of cowardice and protection of terrorism.
Really, so the headline could have said U.S. shields terrorist, but that's not what we went with, huh?
No.
You know, that's the thing. The headline could have said a lot of different things.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of different things would have been true. Terrorist.
More true.
Wanted criminal. More true. And none of them said that.
I mean, the Miami Herald is not necessarily a surprise or ridiculously right wing, especially when it comes to talking about Cuba. But I just don't even understand why the BBC is weighing in on this at all. And especially anti-communist activist? I mean, that's not even close to true.
This reminds me of when a former member of the Venezuelan police hijacked a helicopter, flew over the Venezuelan Supreme Court building, and threw grenades out of the window at the Supreme Court building. I think it was the Washington Post. The formulation they used to describe this act of what is, I mean, clearly terrorism, right? Hijacking an aircraft and then using it to throw grenades at an important public institution. The formulation they used to describe that was helicopter protest, because in addition to grenades, he also hung like a banner out of the helicopter that he had stolen. I mean, it's pretty par for the course.
So grenades is a protest, but when you stand up to police in Ferguson or literally anywhere else and have your hands behind your back,
it's rioting.
That's rioting?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. I think we need to switch from there to some funnier headlines.
Yeah, this is too depressing. This is too depressing. Let's go to another one.
And this one certainly caused a giggle, if nothing else. It's from Gizmodo, a tech publication. Google removes "don't be evil" clause from its code of conduct. So, yes, indeed, Google, whose motto was "don't be evil," no longer claims that they're not going to be evil.
I mean, it's probably more accurate than we were before.
It was a cool thing. In all seriousness, it was a cool thing that they had that in their employee, you know, handbook and in contracts and stuff. But it actually became serious because people were resigning over the artificial intelligence that Google was developing because it had military implications or applications.
I mean, right. So I think when that clause was in there, it's not like they were actually abiding by it, but it was you know, cool that it was there, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Because we spend so much time talking about depressing terrorist Posada Carriles, let's talk about some more funny ones, Steve.
This one actually is my personal funniest for the week, and it's one of these things that could have been listed under one of the worst headlines, but it just made me laugh out loud. It's from the Huffington Post. Kim Jong-un baited Trump into canceling the North Korea summit. If we were on TV, this is the case where you do a spit take. What? It was North Korea who baited Trump into canceling the summit? Was it them who had mind control over Pence and Bolton and made them start talking about the Libyan model?
That's right. Know, he had no choice somehow.
They were just totally under they were hypnotized by some North Korean spy. I mean, did we imagine that North Korea released three prisoners and blew up its nuclear test site? But that was all
like hours before the summit was canceled. They blew up their nuclear test site, and then
this is what they call in the current vernacular three-dimensional chess. It was their clever chess move into getting Trump to cancel the summit.
That's right,
by blowing up their nuclear test site. You know, I mean, it was just unbelievable. and echoed, I should say, by the leader of the Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, who was on TV, and this is a headline from the Washington Post. Pelosi, Kim Jong-un is the big winner. I mean, this is just, this is either misleading or the worst headline, whatever, but to me it was just laugh out loud funny because it's just so preposterous.
It's totally
and
insane.
And, of course, the fact that she's saying that and the Democrats busy attacking Trump from the right, urging us to, you know, stay in a state of hostility and hope for war against North Korea is just, I mean, it's disgusting, of course.
Mm-hmm.
What can you say?
You know, before we went on the air, we were talking amongst ourselves about Nancy Pelosi and how she's completely flipped on this issue, that now it's the Democrats who don't want the administration to engage in diplomacy that could lead to peace, just like they complained that the Republicans were doing in 2003 and 2004. Makes zero sense to me.
And Pelosi specifically, you said, John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's the worst one because she was the one that was leading that fight against Condoleezza Rice back during the Bush administration.
I actually had not seen, I was surprised yesterday to see her face on TV. I hadn't seen her in months, maybe.
She's been very quiet.
She clearly wanted to get back in the spotlight somehow, but I just am in shock that this was the way she decided to do it.
Steve, what else struck you this week?
Well, here's one. Let's switch topics here, but as long as we're talking about the Democrats, this one I have listed under most misleading, although it's also funny, is from the Washington Post. The far left is winning the Democratic Civil War. Again, who is this far left I don't know about that's winning the Democratic Civil War? Well, if you read the article, these quote-unquote far left ideas of these various candidates who have won some of the Democratic primaries, here's what they're advocating. Universal health care, marijuana legalization, universal background checks for buying guns, raising taxes or limiting corporate tax loopholes. So these are now far left ideas, which is remarkable because except for possibly raising taxes, every one of those ideas is supported by the majority or even the vast majority of Americans.
Including Republicans in some cases, right?
Exactly. So either the United States has suddenly become a far left country to my delight, or more likely, these are actually perfectly mainstream ideas and these were actually centrist candidates, not far left candidates at all. But that's what passes for far left in the pages of the Washington Post.
Steve, I really liked your Iran Wall Street Journal headline. Do you want to read that one?
We have about a minute and a half.
Iran uses nuclear pact as bargaining chip with EU over U.S. sanctions. Tehran's suggestion could drive a wedge between Washington and Brussels.
Only is it entirely too long for a headline, first of all, but second of all, it's totally backwards, Steve.
Yes. I mean, the one who broke the nuclear pact was, of course, Trump, not Iran. So if there's any wedge being driven between Washington and Europe, it was driven by the U.S. and by Trump, not by Iran.
Well, maybe Trump was baited again, just like Kim Jong-un did. Do you think that's what
it
was?
Yeah, one of these remote mind control things.
Again, wow, man.
Novichok drug or something.
Right.
You know, they who knows? Here's the headline. This really was misleading, although it was wishful thinking in my view. This is an RT headline, although similar headlines in a lot of other papers, but I like the RT headline. Pentagon report raises alarm that U.S. industry can't support war for much longer. if only.
Oh, God.
Somehow I think they'll manage, but I think that's unfortunately all the time we have.
We're out of time. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Pat. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and now at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.